Hello and welcome everybody to part one of two of our Realist Foreign Policy podcast. My name is Mark Jarrett and I'm the program editor of Canada's NATO here at the NATO Association of Canada. And I'm here with my work colleague Alexi Amini, who is the program editor of Canada's Armed Forces here at the NATO Association of Canada as well. So as I said before, we'll be talking about our realist foreign policy as it is becoming more common in the world, especially with the rise of Trump and even here in Canada, putting the Mali mission on the back burner, which something we'll be talking about in part two of our realist podcast. But to go over the theoretical aspects of realism, realism is about recognizing that there are no perfect options when intervening, only a spectrum of bad options. And the idea is to pick the least bad option or the lesser evil in order to have the lowest amount of damage. So according to the Oxford Handbook of International Relations, there are a few main components that modern realist thinkers believe which make up realist foreign policy. One, states are central actors in international politics rather than international organizations. So states undermining the credibility of international organizations in order to keep everything in check. Secondly, the political system is anarchic, as Hobbes, famous philosopher Hobbes, always mentioned, as there is no supranational authority that can adequately enforce rules over the state unless all major powers cooperate. Third, actors in the international political system function to maximize their own self-interest. So powerful nations will seek to project their own power to the fullest possible extent. Fourth, states desire power to ensure self-preservation. Powerful nations are always on the offensive to expand because they don't know how much military capacity and geographic area and positioning they will need in order to survive. This mentality of every country for itself and that the political system is like a jungle doesn't necessarily mean to seek out war, but to avoid war through maintaining the balance of power. It goes back to the phrase that a state has a monopoly of violence over a given area to prevent a breakout of violence. The purpose is to keep those countries in check and not throw off the balance of power. And we are going to use the example of Iraq, which I will pass over to Alexi to discuss.
Thank you very much, Mark. Well, concerning the Iraq example, we're going to talk about the 9/11 attacks and the subsequent strategic calculus, American calculus, leading to the Operation Iraqi Freedom in 2003. And in this regard, it should bear in mind that following the 9/11 attacks, the U.S. government went to Afghanistan in 2001, Operation Enduring Freedom, to clamp down on al-Qaeda. However, Washington realized that hunting down Islamic terrorism, one fighter after a fighter, is simply not a sound operational plan. The U.S. should focus on the finances of a movement. Most of those finances come from Saudi Arabia, which is an American ally. And according to George Friedman, founder and former CEO of Stratfor, who wrote a book called America's Secret War, Inside the Hidden Worldwide Struggle Between America and Its Enemies, he argues that Saudi Arabia intelligence was aware that you had prominent Saudi citizens financing al-Qaeda. And this is not surprising since Saudi Arabia is steeped in Wahhabi ideology and al-Qaeda is just a product of this political religious ideology. And however, the Saudi government cannot clamp down on the finances because its existence relies on a coalition with the Wahhabi clergy. And by hunting down prominent members of Saudi society, supporting al-Qaeda financially, it will only backfire on the Saudi government and threaten its hold on to power. And with that in mind, the U.S., fully aware of that, knowing that Saudi would not be very cooperative, decided to coerce Saudi Arabia. Like, they had two options. Either the first option was to invade Saudi Arabia, but that would lead to the fall of the Saudi government, and the Saudi state intelligence apparatus had a goldmine of knowledge about al-Qaeda's workings, but that would just backfire because they would lose their main ally, the al-Saud family, and that would also create even more support for al-Qaeda by having U.S. troops invading the Saudi kingdom. So they went for an indirect option, invade Iraq, Why Iraq? Well, because Iraq is actually located at a very strategic position in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
It borders six countries. And by invading Iraq, having a foothold, like a firm military foothold there, it would actually pressure Riyadh to reconsider its position in tackling Al-Qaeda's finances.
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, but also increased U.S. presence within Iraq would actually allow Washington to control Iraq's oil flow, which, let's not forget that Iraq has one of the biggest oil reserves in the world.
Yeah.
And by overflowing the world markets with Iraqi oil, that will only decrease the oil price down, and which it would put the Saudi government in a difficult position, because at that time, oil prices were very low. And with like the entrance of Iraq once again on the global market following an American invasion, it will decrease it even more. And Saudi Arabia will be able to preserve the social peace in the country.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, those were the two effects intended of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. But however, the problem was that although it was sound, the strategic rationale was sound, there was a massive intelligence failure on behalf of the Americans. They omitted completely that following the Gulf War, 1990-1991, Iran actually created a parallel state within Iraq, a parallel state composed of the Shias south of Baghdad. And let's not forget that the Shias constitute 60%
mm-hmm.
of Iraq's population.
Yeah.
When the U.S. actually toppled Saddam Hussein and initiated this de-basification process,
mm-hmm.
it actually, they basically served Iraq to Iran on a silver platter.
Mm.
And the U.S. could have actually co-opted the Iraqi Shias away from Iran and closer to the U.S., but that didn't happen since following the 2003 invasion, there was already a Sunni insurgency brewing in Anbar province,
uh-huh.
and the U.S. decided they're going to placate the Sunnis. Instead, the Shias would feel alienated and grew closer to Iran. So by using this example, we can see that realism in itself, it's not that realist foreign policy creates wars. It's the lack of intelligence failures. This is what actually creates a greater disorder within a region. And thank you very much, Mark. I pass the microphone to you.
Yeah, no problem. So I think that concludes our first episode of this series for this podcast. Just outlining that, once again, realism and intervening isn't necessarily about war and seeking out war, but it's meant to remain the balance of power. And those are the two differences that happened between the two Iraq wars. In 91, when America and various other forces intervened, it was to keep Iraq as a bargaining chip on Iran. The second war in 2003, it clearly, that war was, you know, to keep Saudi in check, but they didn't realize that Iraq had a predominantly Shia population, and Iran took advantage of that de-bathification and power vacuum that was left by the Americans. So that concludes this podcast, and thanks for listening.